never get elected, you know. The avalanche and the thunder now was really a little like Burke. I want that sort of thing. Not ideas, you know, but a way of putting them. Shift the pegs a little, and I shall be in the cabinet and you undersecretary. The little waves make the large ones, eh, and so forth. We'll make a bit of difference in the world, eh, Ladislaw? Excellent.
Tomorrow, Lydgate's reputation is damaged by gossip. George Eliot's Middlemarch stars Caroline Martin as Dorothea and Tom Goodman Hill as Tertius Lydgate. Today you also heard Carl Johnson, Ron Cook, Catherine Igo and Richard Delane. The dramatist is Judith Adams.
The Digital Station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Radio 4 has its book at bedtime, but its younger sister 4 Extra prefers a book at beach time. Lay out your towel in preparation for our new series of holiday reads, beginning with Sophie Kinsella's latest novel. That's in 15 minutes, after another selection of snapshots of 1950s life through the eyes of a wide range of people's diaries, letters and memoirs. Dominic West reads from David Kynaston's Family Britain.
May 1953 was a month of mounting anticipation. Oxford housewife Madge Martin recorded in her diary on the 12th, "Everyone is hoping that either this glorious weather will hold for the coronation, or that it will rain soon and get it over." Across the country, plans for street parties and celebrations were well underway, though in New Malden, Surrey, it emerged that some organisers had been told by parents that they did not want their offspring to mix with common children, prompting a People headline, "They're much too posh for street party." Amid the mounting excitement, the 55-year-old wife of a clerical officer struck a rare religious note.
"I shall spend a good bit of the day on my knees praying for that poor soul. She's so young. I don't think she knows what she's let herself in for. But she's got that beautiful husband beside her. Hasn't he the loveliest face?"
It seems that it was in traditional working-class areas that the coronation was celebrated most enthusiastically. Lily Walk, in Fulham, was a narrow alleyway with 42 houses, mostly lived in by labourers, and on the local council's condemned list. "It'll be the last coronation we'll have down here," a 60-year-old woman explained, "because they're pulling the houses down and we're all going to shift, so we're making it a kind of farewell party too." Money for the street party for the Walk's children had been collected on a regular basis since the previous June, with many people giving up nights at the pub and the pictures to pay for it. By this time, the airwaves were pervaded by the impending event. Accordingly, Woman's Hour on Monday the 1st of June, the day before the coronation, included a talk by a housewife expressing her thoughts on Coronation Eve. She called it dedication.
"Last Christmas, the Queen asked us all to pray for her on her coronation day. She called us, surely, not to lip service, but to share in her personal dedication in the daily round of our own lives. What can this dedication mean to an ordinary housewife like me? The Queen will live to make our nation great, and so must I. While hers may often be in spectacular ways, my own dedication may just be in the caring I put into the tiny details of my everyday life. Yes, even in the washing up. In things like seeing that I wash most carefully round the handles of cups and saucepans. In the thought and preparation that goes into the cooking. Every tiny eye out of the potatoes and spotless hands to cook with."
The name of the 42-year-old speaker, living in Wolverhampton, married to a sheet metal worker bringing up three sons, was Mary Whitehouse, set to return to obscurity, but now having savoured, thanks to the BBC, the buzz of moral exhortation. It proved a pretty wet night for those camping out in central London, with women outnumbering men by about 7-1. Eventually, the damp, huddled masses were rewarded after the 3-hour service in Westminster Abbey. One of the government's mass observation investigators was, as ever, on hand to record the day.
Finally, in a gold state coach drawn by 8 greys, comes the newly crowned Queen Elizabeth. It is all over so quickly that people seem taken aback. They look at each other and smile, almost in a confidential sort of way, or as a kind of sigh, and one or two women are wiping their eyes.
But at least one couple, Dennis and Margaret Thatcher, were smugly dry in the covered stand in Parliament Square.
The tickets were an even wiser investment than Dennis knew when he bought them, for it poured all day and most people in the audience were drenched, not to speak of those in the open carriages of the great procession. The Queen of Tonga never wore that dress again. Mine lived to see another day.
Queen Salotti of Tonga was a highlight for many. The writer James Lees Milne described her as
a vast, brown, smiling bundle with a tall red knitting needle in her hat. She refused to have the hood of her carriage drawn. The people were delighted. They roared applause. Beside her squatted a little man in black and a top hat, her husband. Noel Coward, when asked who he was, said, her dinner.
For the overwhelming majority, of course, the coronation was experienced through radio or television. Diarist Marion Raynham, at home in Surbiton with her husband, son and daughter, listened to it all day.
I took advantage of the religious part to put the lunch on the table. They loved the lunch. Tomato soup, a big salad with nut meat brawn and strawberry blancmange and jam and top of the milk. I didn't waste my time. At the first part, I pulled the couch out and spring-cleaned behind it and brushed it well. Did the room, later crocheted, then later rested. They do this well. I like the bit about justice in the ceremony and the voices of the Queen and Philip. She never seems nervous.
Yet it was undeniably television's day. No less than 20 million people, more than half the adult population, watched at least half an hour of the service, not far short of double the radio audience. People watched where they could, and improvisation was often the order of the day. Ned Sherrin fondly remembered his family's pioneering television experience in rural Somerset.
The whole village clubbed together to rent one, which they put in my father's barn. I came down from Oxford. It was a sensation. The local squire even came down to watch, with binoculars and a shooting stick.
Overall, there is little disputing the conventional wisdom that the coronation made television in Britain. And partly due to Richard Dimbleby's commentary, the coverage gave the medium an irreproachable respectability, a sense of it moving for the first time to the centre of national life. But as the excitement of the coronation died away, another royal soap opera was just beginning. And this one would hold the nation in thrall for more than 2 years. The Queen Mother looked very happy and radiant, a Cheshire schoolgirl wrote in her essay about going to London and attending the coronation procession. But Princess Margaret looked rather sad. If not sad, certainly preoccupied. For the divorce of the 38-year-old group captain Peter Townsend, now serving as controller to the Queen Mother's household, had gone through the previous December, while the bond between the 22-year-old Margaret and the war hero had grown ever closer. On Coronation Day itself, while the two were standing near each other in an anteroom to the Abbey, an observant foreign reporter noticed how she brushed away, with a tender hand, a piece of fluff on his RAF uniform. Assumptions of intimacy were made, and next morning the story broke in the New York press. 11 days later, on Sunday the 14th, the People ended the British silence. Under the headline, "They Must Deny It Now," and next to photographs of the two, A front-page editorial began.
It is quite unthinkable that a royal princess, third in line of succession to the throne, should even contemplate a marriage to a man who has been through the divorce courts.
The decision was taken, by a mixture of court, government, and Townsend himself, that he would be posted abroad for 2 years as air attaché at the Brussels embassy, and that the romance would be put on hold until after Margaret's 25th birthday in August 1955. Margaret herself, at the end of June, accompanied her mother on an official visit to Rhodesia. All over the country, it was now the great talking point. Housewife Nella Last in Barrow-in-Furness reflected many people's confusion in her diary entry of 9th of July.
Wondering how they could ever think the match would be approved after the Duke of Windsor's affair. There's so much church disapproval. But times have changed. I often feel a bit surprised at the number of divorces in our own town and district. Women don't stand what they used to take for granted, desertion and cruelty, as well as unfaithfulness. No one thinks as they used to do, and everything seems so fluid and so chaotic.
The press and the public didn't forget the story during Townsend's 2 year absence. And as the princess's 25th birthday approached in August 1955, the papers took up the saga again with relish. "Come on, Margaret," screamed the front page of the Daily Mirror, adding, underneath a large photograph of her, "Please make up your mind." The press coverage only increased in intensity during the autumn. Nella Last was discussing the situation with her Daily Help on the 13th of October.
"Mrs. Atkinson came in. She had got me some yeast. She said idly, 'Looks as if you're going to be right, that Princess Margaret will marry Townsend. Seen the paper yet?' We discussed it. We both felt regret that she couldn't have married a younger man. Mrs. Atkinson too has principles about divorce that I lack. I wasn't prepared for my husband's wild condemnation or his outburst about my far too easygoing way of looking at things. I poached him an egg for tea."
That evening in London, the storm-tossed couple had 2 hours together at Clarence House. "Townsend visits Margaret," and "Now the nation waits," were among next morning's headlines. On Tuesday the 18th, the cabinet discussed the question and took a collective view that if Margaret went ahead and married Townsend, she would lose both her rights of succession and her civil list allowance. "Princess Margaret" was the authoritative title of the main leader in the Times a week later. Almost certainly the work of the paper's editor, Sir William Hayley, in effect, this was the establishment seeking to deliver a knockout blow in order to end an unseemly, even dangerous, controversy. After describing the enormous popular emotion on the subject as sentimental and ill-informed, he continued,
"There is no escape from the logic of the situation. The Queen's sister, married to a divorced man, even though the innocent party, would be irrevocably disqualified from playing her part in the essential royal function. Her fellow subjects will wish her every possible happiness, not forgetting that happiness in the full sense is a spiritual state, and that its most precious element may be the sense of duty done."
This did the job, for Townsend subsequently recalled that, after reading it, he and Margaret had privately agreed that it would be impossible to go ahead. As ever, the Mass Observation Project sought to gauge reaction to the no-marriage announcement amongst the public. One woman said,
"I am deeply distressed by her decision. It came as almost a physical shock. It was as if we had suddenly started to move back towards the darkness of some primitive jungle, as if a beautiful young girl had been sacrificed to its gods."
But a widow in her 50s caught the other, more pragmatic side of the public mood.
"Is the glow of romance enough? Of course not. Or only in novelettes. Would she have liked being a stepmother and a déclassé princess? Not Margaret."
Dominic West was reading From Family Britain by David Kynaston, with additional readings by Emily Bevan, Madeline Brolly, Matt Fraser and Nigel Coombs. It's abridged and produced by Jane Greenwood. In the next part, you can hear how the arrival of commercial TV helped to transform Britain into a consumer society. That's on Wednesday at 2:15, because at this time tomorrow...
Ambridge Extra returns to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
He was the most wonderful, kind-hearted man I've ever met. Then there were misunderstandings.
I'm sorry.
I got angry. And then he was gone.
The story continues as Matt and Lillian face the truth.
Oh, never mind. Let's just forget it.
What?
Well, you're clearly hating every minute of this.
What are you talking about?
Doesn't matter.
Ambridge Extra begins Tuesday afternoon at 2:15.
The digital station for comedy, drama and entertainment. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Great Expectations continues in half an hour, and then in the 4 o'clock show, Mel takes us behind the scenes of a real-life circus. Before all that, roll up for the return of 4 Extra's series of summer reading that's a sort of love child of Book at Bedtime and Desert Island Discs. Book at Beach Time. This week, Sarah Alexander and Sophia DiMartino are the readers of this sparky comedy which charts the romantic misadventures of two sisters, Fliss and Lottie.
Book at Beach Time. Wedding Night by Sophie Kinsella. Part 1.
You spell my natural emotions. It makes me feel like dirt and I'm hurt.
I've bought him an engagement ring. Was that a mistake? I mean, it's not a girly ring. It's a plain band with a tiny diamond in it. If Richard doesn't like the diamond, he can always turn it round. I wonder if he's bought a ring. I sip my water and smile lovingly at Richard. We're sitting at a corner table overlooking the river. All black and white marble and vintage chandeliers. The perfect place for a lunchtime proposal. I'm wearing an understated bride-to-be white shirt, a print skirt, and have splashed out on stay-up stockings, just in case we decide to cement the engagement later on. As he sees me watching him, he smiles too.
So?
I'm getting misty-eyed already. I've been like this for days, ever since I realised what he was driving at. First he set up this date and called it a special lunch. Then he referred to a big question he had to ask me and half-winked. I almost wish he'd been more roundabout and this was going to be more of a surprise. But there again, at least I knew to get a manicure. In the 3 years Richard and I have been together, I've deliberately avoided the question of marriage, commitment and all associated subjects. We sort of live together at his place, but I still have my own flat. We're a couple, but at Christmas we go home to our own families. We're in that place. After about a year, I knew we were good together. He's not the show-offy kind, Richard. He's measured and deliberate. Sometimes you think he's not even listening, but then he'll come to life so suddenly, you realise he was alert the whole time, like a lion half asleep under the tree, but ready for the kill. Whereas I'm a bit more of a gazelle, leaping around. We complement each other. It's nature. Not in a food chain sense, obviously. I'm ready for this. I'm 33 years old, and I'm ready. I can feel the love flowing between us over the table.
Lottie?
Richard has noticed my damp eyes.
Are you okay? What's up?
Sorry. I dab at my eyes. Nothing, I just wish you didn't have to go. Richard is flying off tonight to a secondment in San Francisco. It's 3 months, but I'll miss him terribly. In fact, it's only the thought that I'll have a wedding to plan which is distracting me. Richard grins and grasps my hands more tightly.
I love you.
His voice is low and warm and melting.
In fact, Lottie, I have something to ask you. Oh, God, he's doing it. My whole life changes here. Concentrate, Lottie. Savour the moment. Wait, what's wrong with my leg? I stare down at it in horror. Whoever made these stay-up stockings is a liar and will go to hell because one of them has collapsed around my knee and there's a plastic strip flapping around my calf. I can't be proposed to like this. I can't spend the rest of my life looking back and thinking it was such a romantic moment. Shame about the stocking. Sorry, Richard, I cut him off. Just wait a sec. Surreptitiously, I reach down and yank the stocking up, but the flimsy fabric tears in my hand. Richard looks a little baffled as I emerge from under the table. I have to go to the ladies. I'm sorry, can we put things on pause? I bang through the door of the ladies, wrench off my shoe and stupid stocking.